All right, so go see if it comes back down.
Bruce, you and I, Bruce?
So what?
I'm going to crawl in.
Yeah, I'll hang on stuff too.
Anna will let you know.
Okay,
hold on. My collar.
Okay.
Did it
run?
Oh, your collar?
Yeah.
No, I don't touch your collar.
What if Jason just...
Okay, so...
Hey, you want to slip here?
Yeah, we can do that.
Shower.
We're
not together, of course.
No,
cannot
put
that.
Well, you want to sit? We can sit here.
Yeah. Let's do stuff.
All this stuff gotta go down.
About you on the Hokulea website.
Okay.
Sound like quite a waterman.
Oh, God. We're all like that.
Oh.
All these guys.
When you're done, Bruce, when you're ready.
Canoe paddlers, surfers, fishermen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, where do we begin? Well, let's talk about... tell me about that before we start talking about the Hokulea. So... give me a little rundown about where you grew up, what you did, how you ended up in this situation.
Right. So I grew up on Oahu, the island of Oahu, in Kulio'o, which is on the southeast corner of Oahu. And pretty much, like, almost everyone I knew... we grew up surfing, and then then we got into canoe paddling at a young age, 13. And we still paddle. We all still paddle, you know, recreationally and competitively. And all through the years too, we became fishermen of sorts.
Anna, you ready to go for it?
And divers. And so when this project came along, Hokulea, in 1975, it was really fascinating. And it was only, actually, the beauty of it was only, this canoe was built for one voyage in 1976 to sail down to Tahiti and back. But it was so fascinating within itself, so many stories... and connections are made, and so many stories are told, and so many connections made that we were just like, I think it was understood that we were just like touching the tip of the iceberg as far as culture, the possibility of learning and a rediscovery of our roots and connection to others throughout the Pacific. And so anyway, it just kept going, and I got involved in 1977, right the next year after that. And I've been sailing with them ever since.
So 76, did they actually make it to Tahiti? I know the first voyage
they didn't make it anywhere,
right?
No, they did.
Oh, okay.
So 76 voyage with that first crew, the original crew, they were the navigation was done by our teacher, a Micronesian navigator, master navigator for Satawal, Mao Piai Lug. And their first landfall was the atoll of Matahiva. And then from there they went to Tahiti, and it was like, oh, that was huge. You know, just the whole concept of him guiding the canoe, you know, by the stars and the sun and the moon and planets and the wind and the waves and all of that. It was so unbelievable. So I was on the second voyage, 78. That's the one that was really short-lived when we got turned over and Eddie Aikau got lost at sea. So that was the second voyage.
Okay. I thought that was the first one, yeah.
No, that
okay.
was the second one. Yeah. That was 1978.
So you were on that voyage?
Yep. Yep. So that was my first voyage, my first experience. And then Eddie Aikau and... I mean, a lot of guys. There were a few guys from the first crew, but mostly all new guys. Yeah.
Yeah, so do you feel like talking about that voyage at all? The one from
I can, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we're gearing up. We started training in 77, but, I mean, we trained mainly in... you know, outside of Waikiki, and we did a lot of sheltered water kind of training. We never got into the deep water and the big stuff. But it wasn't so much that. The canoe was really good. That evening we left on that voyage, it was like raging. And it had been blowing about 30 plus knots on the, you know, through the islands. Probably for about three or four days before. So the whole seas and everything were developed. It was crazy. Anyway, we got out there. And now, between each yako, each cross member, on each hull, right beneath each cross member, there's a watertight bulkhead. So we have seven sealed off compartments. And then there's a 3-inch standpipe pipe that goes down. It's a 1/4 inch off the bottom, and so you can pump water if that gets in there without opening the hatch. Well, and that was a result. That design was the result of that swamping and the turnover in '78. But prior to that redesign. There weren't watertight bulkheads. And there was like, you know, the bulk, you had a bulkhead and it came up a little bit, but water could jump from one to the other. And so hence, you know, it was so rough. I mean, we're just taking water in the front. It was just coming in like buckets. And so we had been, you know, we left to get on a voyage probably about 5 p.m. in the evening. And so really by about 8:30, you know, it was starting to flood. It was coming in that much. So it was just one of those crazy things, inattentiveness, poor seamanship. And anyway, it all resulted in swamping and then a capsizing. Yeah. So that was that. And we was at sea upside down for about a day. So all through the night, that night, and all through the next day, and then that next night is when we got spotted by aircraft, Inter-Island Airlines, Hawaiian Airlines. They spotted one of our flares.
And what was your role on the boat that trip?
I was just a fisherman. Yeah.
And you guys were headed to Tahiti.
We were headed to Tahiti. The other thing was, another crazy thing was... we didn't have a companion vessel, like now we have Gershon 2. We didn't have a companion vessel. They had all this communication gear on board that leadership within the society felt that was more than accurate to stay in communications in case of emergency. Well, hell, good thing it all happened like right there, right? In the channel, right, between Oahu and Molokai, because... actually between Oahu and Lanai, because that was in that hall, and it all swamped, and it's underwater, and it's useless. Anyway.
Yeah. Huh. So that was a big learning. It was a very short, but big on learning.
Big on learning. Big. A fatal, thing, with loss of Ediacao, but was huge on learning and moving ahead. So since then, so here's another statistic is, up to that point, the voyage to Tahiti is one way is 2,500 miles. So the first voyage in 1976 was 5,000 miles. And then all the inter-island training and everything, you could probably add another 2,000 miles. So up to that point, the canoe had sailed, 7,000 miles. But after all of that refit and the redesign, she sailed over 150,000 miles over the years up to this point. So all those little things, the watertight bulkheads, we raised the hatches down there, the combings coming up, and those standpipes to get the water out. And so that's all helped to keep safe.
After the 78, after that voyage, it didn't turn you off from sailing.
Oh, no. I was still stoked about it. A couple guys, most of us came back and sailed. Actually, from that voyage, I think there were about 3-4 guys that never came back. But most of the guys all came back to continue on, yeah. Okay. Aloha.
Yeah, and so you stayed on with Hokulea. Did you go to your own thing and come back to Hokulea? You've been with Hokulea the
yeah.
whole time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which one?
Hokulea.
Whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at that time, this was the only canoe in the 70s. And all through the 80s, this was the only canoe.
How much room do you have?
In the 90s is when other canoes were starting to be being built. Yeah. And actually it was 95 when some of the other canoes that are traveling throughout the Pacific were built. So there's one on a big island, Makali'i.
Uh-huh.
Was built in 95 and did her first voyage then. Actually, in 92, they built Te Aurere in New Zealand. And Te Aurere sailed in 92. And then I think she was the only other one. And in the Cook Islands, they had built two canoes. One was 92, they built the Takitumu. In 95, they built the Te Aotonga. And then we built another canoe in 95 back home called Hawaii Loa. It was built from native materials.
Is it still afloat?
It's still afloat. There's a group that takes care of her. She's not doing a whole lot of sailing. But, she's still afloat. She's a great canoe.
So, out of all of the... it sounds like you surf, you fish, you sail, you paddle. So, out of all of it, does it feel like, this is where my heart really is?
That's what I enjoy.
Out of all of it, is there something in particular? It's like, is it when you're on the canoe or is it when you're on your surfboard? Do you feel like, is there one or the other? Do you feel like, finally, this is me?
Well, that's when I'm paddling, actually. Especially when we're doing ocean races, inter-island and stuff like that. I really enjoy that. I do enjoy this. But the thing I like about the paddling, it keeps me stronger and healthier. With this, there's not a whole lot of... it's just more mental than physical. It's more mental and spiritual than physical. The paddling is all of it. So I really enjoy that.
And so what's the point? What's the point of getting on a boat, smacking yourself around in the waves to get from one place to the next when you could just fly... You can take a car. You don't need to do that anymore. So what's the point? No. What's the point of it?
Yeah, the major thing, I'm glad you asked that question. Someone asked me that question yesterday. So one major thing is that, you know, the Hawaiian culture and the Hawaiian people were just crushed, you know, by, you know, a bunch of Western force, colonization, you know, missionary stuff, religion, the whole thing. And it got to a point where, I mean, it's if you ask anybody, if anybody was anybody on this planet was able to look at things that they held dear to themselves, you know, spiritual beliefs, religion, family values and everything, and you got that just crushed to the point, even your language, you know, how you express yourself, crushed to the point where it was like invalid, and you using it is like shameful and invalid, and you become like a second-rate citizen in your homeland, then the cultural aspect of who we are just went down, almost died. So my grandparents, my parents, they had very little, if any, affiliation or connection to their culture. So in the 70s, so that was a point in the 70s when a lot of it was being coming around, a lot of those questions. You know, what is a Hawaiian? What is a Hawaiian culture? What is this? I mean, when you ask questions like that, it's like, really, something's like seriously wrong here. So going forward to this point, when this canoe was built, it was just another way to, first of all, bring a bit of validity and recapture the beauty of like building these canoes and navigating them. Just an incredible feat that really there are people who didn't believe it was ever actually possible. Well, you've been to Tamaka and then you see those guys. I mean, it's not only possible, they live that. Yeah. So for those people, if that was taken away from them, you know, it would be so crushing to them because it's such a big central part of their who they are and what gives them that inner strength, you know, to like live life daily. So the reason we do it is that there's so much to learn, and then like it's our responsibility at this point to get all these younger guys to feel that and learn that and to be the next wave to carry it on. So really, I mean, like, we don't really get beat up out here. You get a little cold, you know, you get a lot of wet, but, you know, shit, we grew up in the ocean, you know, it's not a big thing, you know. So that's mainly it, you know, I mean, this is our culture, and a culture has to be a living culture.
So when you say that your parents and grandparents didn't have any connection to their culture, they weren't out on the water at all? They weren't fishing at all?
They were fishing, but, like, you know, I mean, the language was snatched away. So, I mean, it had no connection to the language. Hula was kind of, like, snatched away. So there was just, like, pockets of that. It's not celebrated now, like, worldwide how it is. The music, because the language is snatched away and the music, in the music is the language and the storytelling, that whole thing was just a jumble of confusion where guys are singing Hawaiian words and not pronouncing them right and not even understanding what the hell the song is about. So there's all this kind of craziness going on. And, I mean, it held on, you know, the people held on to whatever shreds of culture they could hang on to. So anyway, that was just how it was. And so now when I talk to my dad about it, you know, you can just see all these glassy-eyed kind of like, what are you talking about kind of stuff, you know?
What do you mean?
Well, when I talk to him about all the things we're learning about the canoe and the cultures and our connection to the Maori people in New Zealand and the Tahitians and the spiritual nature and all the stories we're learning, that's one thing. But the other thing that we're learning in Hawaii across the board is the illegal overthrow of the islands by a bunch of businessmen, and they were aided and abetted by, you know, military, U.S. military, and learning about that, and then how they treated the queen, you know, Lilukalani at the time, and just all the bogus, crazy things that were going on just in their headlong rush to take over the islands. You know, And then, so they go and do that. And then after that, the annexation of the islands as a territory to the U.S., doing it within their own congressional, in Congress. And not one Hawaiian was there to say no. You know, stuff like that. And so when you look at all of that, and then from that point on, just the laws, like the outlaw, the Hawaiian language. You can't teach it in schools. You can't use it in schools. You can't use it in everyday usage, like in business or anything like that. You know, stuff like that. So slowly but surely, it's just like whittling away at it to just make the culture defunct and almost disappear. So that was the world that they grew up in. So at that point in time, really for survival and the betterment of who they are, hey, just go to school, you know, learn, you know, get as educated as you can and just go to work. Put your nose down and go to work, you know. So that's what they did. And then along come us guys who put our heads up, you know, and we're listening to all the stories, and then, you know, we're getting more aware of all the stuff that happened that they never learned about. So getting back to my dad, when I try and educate my dad and tell him about this, he just sits there and goes, oh, that's real interesting. But he never takes any step to try and learn by for himself and stuff like that, you know. And I guess they just resign themselves just to, that's how it is anyway.
Hang on one sec.
Yeah.
The airport's pretty close, I don't know.
Yeah.
So my cousin actually did a film about Hokulea for National Geographic.
Oh yeah, who's that?
Wade Davis.
Okay, I remember the name, yeah.
Yeah, he went out with you guys, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. A while ago. Anyway, okay, go ahead. As you were.
No, I was just explaining about like that thing with my dad and that generation, right? They're really resigned just to be the really American ideals, I guess, the Western way of life. Just get educated, go to work, make money, take care of your family and stuff like that. And that's okay. I mean, we're all doing that anyway. But at the same time, we're being a part of supporting all the different aspects of the culture that is just blossoming. So like, for instance, Kavika, he's worked with the Immersion Language School in Molokai for years. His wife is like one of the leaders of that. Kaleo there, walking outside with a cap. From high school, not knowing anything, went on to college. He's a really good speaker, you know, native speaker, talking Hawaiian and stuff. And, you know, a lot of the other guys, like our OEVE TV guys, Maui, who's over here, you know, that's basically what they do as native television. They document everything cultural and stuff like that. So it's a big support of that. And every time you support it, you make it stronger and stronger and stronger. And the only reason you make it stronger is because it is part of the land. It's always was part of that land in Hawaii for over a thousand years, and it became invalid to a large degree just for 100 years, for a short time. So now it's a recovery and bounce back and stuff, and it's really pretty awesome.
Do you feel like coming to Tahiti and the other islands helps you with that recovery?
It does, because one thing you understand is that they went through the exact same thing, you know. Tahiti, Cook Islands, Maori in New Zealand. I mean, gosh, the Aboriginals here, I think they probably got it worse than everybody else, you know? But they all went through the same thing, and then they're all going through the same renaissance, resurgence of their culture and stuff. And for no other reason than that culture is the lifeblood of those islands and those people, you know? And so the recovery of it is really a part of restoring the spirit of the land and the people. It's a big, big part. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good thing.
So the other part of it, the other part of the question, why bother, is why bother going out on the ocean? I mean,
That's the only way you can do it.
What do you mean?
That's the only way. I mean, the only way the navigation is valid, and it's gonna stay alive, is that you must voyage. You cannot do it in a classroom. I mean, it's worthless in a classroom. You know, it's like they know that too. It's like native speakers. If you learn Hawaiian language and you learn it in a classroom setting, and you can become proficient. But once you get out, you know, into a Hawaiian community and you start talking, because they have a whole different tempo and their words, you know, get changed a little bit, your ear is like totally, your ear is tuned to like a university taught Hawaiian language. It's not, you know, it's kind of like it's so different. I mean, that's one analogy, but the thing is that these canoes and the spirit of the canoes were built to sail. And so then we come along, and it's our kuleana, our responsibility, to take that next step, to plan for the voyage, to train our crew up. And like, so Kaleo out there with the hat, he's our young navigator. He's one of the young corps of navigators. So right now, we have about maybe 10 or 12 young corps of young navigators that are really good. You know, they know the heavens. You know, they can tell you what star is what direction is what, the movement of the sun and the moon, and they know how to read ocean swells to maintain a relatively decent course, even in like constant overcast, full overcast. So, you know, I mean, that was an art that was totally gone from our islands. So we can do that now. So I guess that's it. I mean, like, you know, we got to carry on. You know.
Yeah. So the ocean is the only place to do that.
That's the only place. I mean, there's a deep sea ocean. Voyaging canoes. They're made for long spans, long distances.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about the canoe, unless I'm wearing you out.
No. Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. So actually, let me grab my fuzzy dead squirrel cover up, because we're getting a little bit of a breeze now. And losing some of your words just to back chatter, but I don't want to lose any to the wind in addition. So.
Oh, how's that?
Oh, isn't that the greatest?
Yeah.
So it just deflects.
Can we put anything smaller first?
Any air.
Yeah, there's a.
That hits it.
That
it just deflects
bag.
The air.
It does, yeah.
You know? And so it deflects the sound that the air causes by hitting it. Yeah, it's great. It's a great thing. It helps immensely. It works like magic. Yeah, this is the
process. So the box,
it's pretty good.
Yeah. So now we're good to go. We can go out into the gale force winds and go over.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, let me see if I'm running. Yep, got a little battery left.
Okay.
All right. So, where were we? Oh, yeah, I wanted you to tell me a little bit about
the canoe.
Because my understanding was the original idea behind the Hokulea was to build like a traditional canoe. And this is not,
no,
strictly
so,
speaking. So, let's talk about the evolution.
It is and it isn't. So, there were no really models of voyaging canoes extant for like well over 400 years in the Pacific. Actually, not in Hawaii anyway. When Captain Cook went to some of the other places like Tonga, Fiji, they had some big canoes. So Hawaii, not for over 400 years. But, I mean, our history, our oral history is based on, this is a huge part of our history. You know, we could name the navigators and the voyaging chiefs, you know. But in the story, but no idea about the canoes. So what happened was Herb Kane, who was a world-renowned artist. You might have heard of Herb Kane.
Yeah, he was my neighbor in Honolulu.
Yeah, there you go. So Herb, I mean, just incredible to all his research, envisioned this canoe, you know, and he drew up. Yeah, that's mine. That's, yeah, stays down there on the shelf. I'm going to put my bag back in there after I'm, yeah, thanks. Herb envisioned the canoe in his art. And then he got Rudy Choi, who was a boat builder and built like tons of catamarans. So Rudy helped Herb. Herb had the design. Rudy helped by lofting it with the length, the width, the depth, the whole thing, to make it able to carry the weight of people and food and water and supplies across the ocean for a month at sea. So, but because, like I said earlier, this canoe was only built for one voyage. This is like a replica of a voyaging canoe. So why go get native materials and go through all of that just to do one voyage down to Tahiti and back? I mean, it doesn't make sense. If you're going to do something like that, you got to have a larger plan than that. So that was really the vision and the scope of the plan, was just to build this in 1 year. So they built the canoe in 1974. They trained the people in 1975 within the islands, and they sailed in 76. And that was it. That was it. And that's why it's built like this. But so the non-traditional part of it is the materials, which is plywood and fiberglass and other materials. But the traditional part is there's over 6 to 8 miles of lashing that holds this whole puzzle together. So that the traditional part is the lashing. The other traditional part are the hoi, the steering mechanisms. And then the other, and then the standing rigging and stuff. But the other traditional part is the navigation. That's the linchpin. That's the essence of it.
But so this, I mean, so Herb came up with a design from what? Where did he get? What did he work?
Just with? All of his research throughout the Pacific, through art renderings of artists on Captain Cook and Vancouver's voyages and all of that, and then other, even like other. La Perouse and other voyages that came through that might have had art. So a lot of it was based on that. A lot of it was based on the canoes that we still had in the islands and just the look of them.
And so what's the point of going out? I hear this is the first voyage out of the Pacific, right?
Yeah.
What's the point of going out? If this is about Polynesian heritage, mm-hmm. Polynesian pride, education, what's the point of going out beyond the Pacific?
Got it. So, you know, since all of the the recovery of the ocean skills and the navigation, we can teach that now. You know, we can teach that. And but this worldwide voyage, so you see this name back here on the solar panel frame, Lacey?
Yeah.
So you ever heard of Lacey Veach?
Mm-mm.
So Lacey Veach was a local boy from Hawaii. He was an astronaut. And in 1992, the Polynesian Voyaging Society, we had a partnership with NASA for education. And it was pretty neat. And we sailed down to the Cook Islands and back from the Cook Islands. And on the way back, there was a particular day that they figured out where the space shuttle was, like right overhead, you know, relatively speaking. And from the canoe, we hooked up with them through single sideband radio, through a dispatch from Hawaii. We had this this entity, there's presence called Peace Satellite, Peace Sat, and they could connect ham radios and single sideband. So we worked with them a lot. But on that voyage, we connected with a space shuttle, and it was just a huge thing, you know. It was just a big thing. But after that voyage.
That was what year again?
That was 1992. So that year, we came in to Kaunakakai, Hawaii. We stopped at Kaunakakai, and the three astronauts on board They were on the space shuttle. They joined us in Kanaka and sailed to Oahu with us, to Kualoa. So it was Lacey Veach, Bill Shepherd. He's one of the kids, a commander. And then Steve McLean, he was a Canadian astronaut. And so those three sailed with us, and we sailed back home. And we had really interesting, fabulous talking with them. So because they had a chance to experience, you know, how we do what we do, how we navigate and all of that. And they were fascinated. But it was just, that whole endeavor was educational. That was like our big first educational push, where educational became very integral to what we do. Anyway, at one of the dinners we had, Nainoa's dad, Myron Thompson, was sitting down at the table with Lacey, and they were just talking about, you know, just the wonders of, you know, the voyaging and everything that's going on and the possibilities and stuff. And so Lacey brought up the basic idea. He just said, well, you know, if this truly is something to be shared, you know, the beauty of it and the possibilities of it, you know, we should share it with the world. So that was 1992. So since 92, 95, we sailed down to Tahiti and back with six canoes. 99, we sailed down to Rapa Nui and back. 2004, we sailed up to the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, all the way up the line to Kure and back. 2007, we sailed to Japan and shipped the canoe back. And then in 2009, we sailed to Palmyra and back. And it's always been, education was always integral. And then 2010, we took the canoe out of the water and we just stripped her down to a bare hull and we rebuilt her again because there was a lot of dry rot. But this was the time to go pick up where that conversation ended, that maybe you should go around the world. So from that time, it was, you know, it's just been a lot of think tanks and connections and partnerships, and really what this whole voyage is about is that it's a good time to try and use the canoe as an ambassador for friendship, education, and just basic benefit for, you know, all those who really don't have, who just get run over, you know. So celebrating Native wisdom, celebrating Native voices, and connecting and trying to get people on board to help figure out or get in, you know, use our resources and sharing knowledge to take that next step to deal with sea level rise, other environmental misgivings and things like that. So a lot of the voyage centers, a lot of this voyage centers around education, relating to culture and the environment, which is something at the heart of cultures throughout the world. And so that was the idea. And it's not so much that we're, it's nothing to do with we have something special to share. I think one thing special to share is the va'a, because what the va'a brings is a whole concept of dreaming the impossible dream and actually making it happen. That's the biggest part of it. And it brings that up. But it really is about meeting people, talking to people, getting their stories, seeing what fascinating, wonderful things that they're doing in their own land that would probably be beneficial in other people's places. You know, I had things that they never even thought about, that these guys are already two steps ahead of everybody else, you know, because they've been that much smarter, you know, or wiser. So that's what this voyage is about. And it's also about, on the other part of it, like I talked about earlier, was building the capacity in the next generation of voyagers to take over to be the next generation of leaders. Because this guy's getting old already. You know, we're all like close to 60. And, you know, our voyaging days are numbered big time.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, you know, actually going to see, I mean, on this plaque back here are all the names on the, is that plaque back there with names?
Let me take a look while you're
It says Nau Makua back there on the
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Those are all people who have sailed, have passed on. All those people have passed already. They've either sailed on the Va'a in past voyages, or they've been major supporters that have helped the voyaging efforts. And those names are from the Pacific Rim. So those are their names on there from, mostly from Hawaii, but from everywhere we've traveled, Tahiti, Marquesas, Rapa Nui, Cook Islands, New Zealand's Setawa, you know, Micronesia, Alaska, and that's pretty much it. All the places we've traveled, and so they've all these those years they even travel with us, or they really worked hard to support it, to make it happen. Yeah.
Yeah. So, as you know, I'm pals with your escort boat, and I'm really interested in the relationship between your escort boat and your boat.
Yeah, so basically, they're there for safety reasons. So a good example of when we left New Zealand, like when we were in Auckland, I mean, they had to get the canoe up the line to Aorere, which was about, I don't know, over 100 miles or so. And you know, because the winds were like just either calm or like in your face, you know, we don't have the luxury of waiting weeks, you know. Just because of the nature of the voyage, there is like a schedule that you want to try and, within reason. So they towed the canoe up there because this has no motor. And so that's what they did. And then we were there, and then when we left New Zealand, they towed us out of the harbor. So that's really one of their big things, is to help us enter and exit ports like this. Like, they got us here with a little dinghy and stuff. And then, but once we get outside and we're clear, then we break away and we just sail, and they just follow us. And in case of a man overboard, in case of any kind of crazy emergency, that's where they assist, yeah? The man overboard is really the biggest one. The other one that they would escort boats have assisted in is in 1987, we had one of our guys, older guys, he had a real bad infection on his leg that never he couldn't get past. And the doctor, after 20 days at sea, the doctor used up all the antibiotics that we had on board, all the bandages, and just made the decision, we got to medevac this guy, he's going to lose his leg. So where the escort boat comes into play is just to keep the navigation on board here pure and, you know, unobstructed. They would work with radioing, you know, for the rescue efforts and stuff, and give them the position and everything so they can kind of home in on where we are. And then we did a Navy ship came out, and we did a medevac at that time. So this last voyage, we're fine, we're sailing, they followed us until we're about like just outside of Lord Howe Island. And because there's a big low out here with big winds, the winds at that time were either going flat or it was like totally in our face in the west. And if we didn't get them to just tow us, get us in here, we'd still be out there for about like 3-4 more days, right? And nothing's wrong with that, but we're expected to be in Sydney on the 15th, you know, and we had kind of planned it to have a nice cushion of time, but we're not going to make the 15th. Yeah, but there's a lot going on over there with education. We're going to be there a week doing education and outreach and cultural things and whatever, which that's part of what the crew is trained in and what they're going to be doing. So that's really what the escort boat you know? And before it was like for documentation as well, but not so much anymore.
So you don't have, so tell me what instrumentation you don't have. So you don't have a GPS.
We do.
Oh, you do have GPS.
If we need to use it, we use it, but it's tucked away and nobody ever looks at it. And then we have a chart plotter in there. In case of emergency, we can use it, like I said, man overboard. That's what we'd use.
And then what else do you have that's that you is just for emergency?
Like on that man overboard pole back there, yeah. You see that horseshoe?
Yeah,
that horseshoe is up, that's the man overboard pole going across. Wrapped up in that little black case, there's like an individual man overboard signal that AIS can pick up. We have things like that, and you know, we have satellite capability through that, through our EV, and they're constantly sending like daily reports and photos about, you know, what's going on here. And we've got like hundreds of thousands of classrooms, and including classrooms and others around the planet that are following the voyage and asking questions and doing things.
And so I'm assuming this is all because of that voyage in 78 that you have this instrumentation, right? Because the first
No, it was really because of the very first voyage, just which kind of brought to the forefront the value of this, the value of the canoe educationally, culturally. And it just kind of, the technology is here now, right? So like I said, in 1980 was our second voyage. We didn't have any of this. It was kind of like almost the same as a 76 voyage. We sailed down, we sailed back. And then 85 to 87, we sailed from Hawaii all the way to New Zealand and back. It was a 3-year effort. We had single sideband on board, and we did a bit of stuff, but no education. And in 92, like it was that next time, when we were partners with NASA, that's when the education kicked into gear big time. And since then, it's all been about, I mean, that's just been integral and expected, you know, the educational part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the meaning that the instrumentation is helping you to get from point A to point B to do the work of the education. Is that what you mean?
No.
Oh.
No.
Okay.
So, I mean, I kind of get for your question the navigation part from point A to point B? Or
So I guess I just assumed that there must have been a debate at some point with Hokulea between like traditionalists who wanted to have, you know, a canoe that only went under sail, that only used traditional navigation, that only, you know, and people who might have been more focused on the canoe performing other tasks and so providing it with more amenities. So was there ever that kind of debate?
No, because a lot of this technology wasn't around back then, right, in the 70s. And the number one overriding factor is safety of the crew and the canoe. So because we're doing this voyage, and we have a lot more stuff on board now, but because we're going through places like the Tasman Sea, the Indian Ocean, around Cape of Good Hope, South Atlantic, places we've never been that can be pretty freaking notorious, you know, for bad weather. You know, safety is going to be a big part of it, is like having the capacity to get information to deal with it. I mean, that's what happened with this one, right? It's like, you know, those guys, we got email, they can email us, we call them back home, and they just go, you know, you guys got some really bad weather coming in. It's going to be light, which it was. It's going to be like this. It's probably better to just get on the giddy up, you know, get tow from Gershon and just hit it, get to the next port, you know? And that's exactly what we did.
Mm.
And then from here we get down to Sydney and up to Brisbane, and, you know, we did enough good stuff for the navigation prior to that and other canoe performance that's all good.
So, but can you seek out that same information from Gershon? Because they definitely would. Yeah. So.
Well, we could, but they were having a lot of problems. Like their AIS kept going down, and they don't have the email capabilities that we have, and they weren't receiving the emails that were sent to them. So there's a big hole there that kept So we just have the, I mean, part of an expedition and going into the wild like that is having some redundancy, you know?
Uh-huh.
Because it's not just, this isn't just like going in, I mean, it is, you're going into the wilderness regardless, you know, being 1,000 miles from anywhere. And then you deal with whatever you deal with, you know, storms, big seas, whatever. But this isn't like, you know, expedition for survival or anything. That's an expedition for culture and learning and education.
Oh, because my understanding from Steve was that he had information about the weather that
he gets the weather. Yeah, and
he
that's fine.
He wasn't supposed to
no,
give you. Or,
no.
He's not supposed to.
No.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, all right.
Unless it's really brutal, you know, unless it's really bad. But those calls, like, I know I was back home, and, you know, because he's the overall head of this project, you know, a lot of the weight and the stresses of those kind of things fall on his shoulder, you know. So the basic understanding is he won't step in and do anything or say anything unless he feels that it's compromising safety. And if he feels that it's compromising safety, then he's going to start communicating and, you know, help work through that process of dealing with it.
Okay, so Nainoa actually is tracking you guys all the time.
Well, everybody tracks us, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the weather, yeah. I mean, because that's a tracker right there, that little half dome.
Uh-huh.
And that's a tracker. And then they're on both of our canoes. So you go on the website, you see exactly where the canoe is. And so that's what that is. But then through that, you know, when he's monitoring, I mean, it's just his thing, you know, monitoring the weather. You know, he can see where we are, what the weather's like, what's crossing our path and stuff like that. Because we've sailed in, like, heavy weather with this guy. And she does well.
Yeah, so
yeah,
I hear.
She does well. 2009, we sailed home from Palmyra. And it was over 30 knots the whole time, big seas. We just, like, went over a 70-foot rogue wave and everything. It was crazy. You know, it was really rough, but she did really a great job. And that was kind of at the tail end of, that was right before we just did a full refit. You know, there was a lot of rot in her and stuff like that. So she's always done really well.
Was that scary?
No, not really. Not for me. But I think for some of the guys on board, it's kind of scary. Like the big seas hit the canvas we ripped the canvas like 4 times in that voyage. You know, a big wave would break and just, boom, hit the canvas and rip it. And we'd get out our sail repair kit and patch it all up. And, you know, a day or two later, boom, another wave hit it, break it, and sew it up. And so we ended up doing that about 4 times.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's good to hear, like, your whole kind of logical explanation about why you're voyaging. And it makes a lot of sense. And it sounds really powerful, but it also, I mean, I just get the feeling that there's something more to it.
It's very spiritual. At the heart of what it is spiritual. It's the heart of the culture. It's the heart of us guys. It's not a project, you know. It's become, you know, to keep the va'a going and other things that are culture and nature, you have got to make it part of your life. You know, like, you know, we've become, to that degree, us, our generation, the older guys, have become the teachers. We've become what they call kubo, right? It's a source of information. So it is our responsibility, to that large degree, to, because we're like the receptacles of information, you know, the holding of a lot of that knowledge, is we got to teach.
Yeah, so yeah. There's the actual knowledge, like the how-to, but then what's the other aspect of it?
It's
knowledge?
Just the spiritual nature of the culture. I mean, that's the... Like I said, I mean, if you go to, like, and you've been to Taumako and those places and stuff, the navigation and a lot of other things within that culture is the linchpin of who they are and what they feel deep inside and why they hold their heads up and they feel that inner strength that we should all feel. You know, it's not like arrogance or pride or anything, but it's like something that can carry you through the worst days of your life. You know, and so with that being said, it is a culture. I mean, I just read some book. Gandhi had said that, you know, the culture is the spirit of the people. You know, it's not just doing things a certain way. It is the heart and the soul and the spirit of the people. And, it's really interesting because I've seen, after going, growing up with, in the younger years, when it was basically not even part of our existence in the islands, to like, '70s, even in the University of Hawaii back then, Hawaiian culture only had like one little classroom. And it was being, the stuff that was being taught was being, it was written by a Westerner that learned as much as he could about Hawaiian culture. And so many things were left out. But when the Hawaiian, in the 90s, after the Hawaiians, whole Hawaiian Studies campus was built on the University of Hawaii, since then, most of the graduates within the Hawaiian Studies curriculum have either gone on to get their master's or a doctorate. And all those guys who got doctorates, they have rewritten the history. And they've really showed why a lot of the early histories there's just so much absence of some real substance, so many half-truths, untruths, and stuff like that. And just some simple things like the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. It was never taught, never taught. And there's a reason it was never taught. They don't want anybody to know, for whatever reason. But now all this stuff is coming around in full circle. It is important. Every little aspect of the culture and the strength of it is important. So kind of getting back to your question, why we sail, that's at the heart of it, That's why we sail.
So can you imagine in your head, was it any particular day or some day where it kind of all, where you were sailing and it kind of all came together for you?
Oh my gosh. I guess. Like, I did my first navigation as an apprentice in 92. And talk about deer in the headlights, you knew everything academically, but you didn't know it instinctually. So that was, all right. Then the next voyage I did in 95, that was my first solo voyage. And that was good. That worked out for the most part, but it wasn't complete. And then 99, I did my third solo voyage, and that was also really good. But it just really didn't feel complete. And I think was after all the voyaging we did, it was really good. But I think 2000, coming home from Tahiti, and it wasn't really voyaging, but I was helping some of the younger navigators learn. And I had decided at that time just to keep the navigation, everything more instinctual and simple instead of so academic. And at that point, became more relaxed, and it worked out. It worked actually better, other than trying to think with so many figures and everything. For instance, just working with the moon and stuff like that. So there was one story of this gal who was navigating on the way home, in 2000. And we got totally overcast. She knew the stars and everything so well. As long as you have stars in the sky, she could pinpoint, with accuracy where she's headed. But then we got totally overcast, and she was just like stressed out. And then so she came to me. She goes, I don't know what to do and stuff like that. And so I said, well, using the swells, yeah, but I'm not real confident. So I said, well, have you seen the moon yet? And she goes, oh, no. And she turns around, and the moon is like right where it's supposed to be. And she's right on course. So I said, you're doing good. You're right on course. There's your moon. Work with that, that glow of the moon. Oh, man, I could just see all this weight just drop off her shoulders, and she got back in the groove, right? But that was a great example of just using things instinctively and stuff like that, instead of totally numbers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
On that voyage. So after that voyage, I just get more comfortable with the whole thing. And, you know, to tell you the truth, the thing is that, you know, we've learned the navigation at such a late age. I mean, at that time, I was in my 30s when I was learning it. And it's not ideal. You should be learning it when you're a younger individual. So we can do it. We can do the navigation. We can teach it. It's really awesome that these guys are learning it, you know, right out of high school and all of that. And like I said, they're doing it. Hey, how you doing? Oh, look at that. So he just got some honey. So what did you say? What were you doing over there? You were not harping.